Welcome to the Demimonde Podcast, an unofficial podcast covering the Showtime series Penny Dreadful. We are No Ship Network. I am your host, Em.
And I am your host, Steve.
If you want to join our discussion, you can reach us by visiting our website at noship.net. Click anywhere it says contact and it will direct you to the various means you can use to reach us. Of course, this is the last episode of the season. We will do a bonus podcast. You can write us and we may feature your feedback on our bonus. If you want to write us and tell us your predictions for season two, that would be great.
That's a really good idea.
Yeah, we did that with Vikings, so we had a lot of contributors for that. It made the bonus really fun. If you have any ideas, you can email us, tweet at us, write us on Facebook. All those methods are available to you at our website if you want to contact us. Okay. Also, if you would like to support us, one way is to rate us on iTunes. You can click on some stars if you're shy about writing anything, or you can write something. We got a new review from our longtime listener from The Wild Hunt, Wiley D. Cody. So that was a very nice review. Thank you.
Yeah, much appreciated. Thanks a lot.
And I think you're going to say more about her at the end.
Yeah.
So before we move on into the recap, I just want to talk about last episode really quickly. So what Ethan was saying last episode as translated was St. Jude, glorious apostle, faithful servant, friend of Jesus, pray for her. Maybe that's a loose translation. So that, just in case anybody wanted to know and didn't know, that was that. Supposedly that's a fairly common prayer, so maybe it's not far-fetched that he knew that.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, we could talk about that later as far as, because that gets addressed in one of our listeners' feedbacks, whether he had went to some sort of religious school or something like that.
Okay. So this episode's called The Grand Guignol. What did you think of this episode?
It was bittersweet. It's just like the last episode of any season of any great, great show that I watch. It's bittersweet. You know, you're getting to the closure of a storyline, so that's good. But then at the same time, you're thinking in the back of your head when you're watching it, I'm not going to see any more of this stuff for 7 or 8 months. So it's kind of a bummer at the same time.
Yeah, it is a bummer.
But the Scooby Gang was in full effect for the first time, really, in this episode. So.
And I love the Scooby Gang so much now.
Mm-hmm.
So it is sad that we're not going to see them for a while.
It'll just make it all the more better. You know, what do they say? Loneliness makes the...
makes the heart grow fonder. Like, distance makes the heart...
Distance, that's it. Yeah, distance makes the heart grow fonder.
This episode was written by John Logan, of course, and directed by James Hawes. Snow falls quietly outside of Malcolm Murray's place. Ives tells Malcolm Murray that she had a vision, and she repeats, "Claw will slash, teeth will rend." She thinks Mina is at the theater, and Malcolm Murray talks about how he has faced the reality that he may have to kill Mina. And she asks if this will bring him peace, and he tells her not to be naive, and he is going to call the others. He's when he says not to be naive, he's very...
Yeah, it doesn't suit you. He's like, it abrasive. Doesn't suit you.
But she seems unfazed by his abrasiveness.
Yeah, I mean, they've been through a little bit together, so it's kind of like, you know, especially her.
And she remains in the room, and it is like she knows Dorian has arrived before it's announced to her.
Mm-hmm.
And he's glad that she's recovered. She says she is quite herself.
That kind of goes over his head, but yeah. To the watcher, to the viewer, it's very significant.
And he has traveled because he wasn't able to see her. And then she welcomes him back rather coldly. And he asks her to read his future. And she says she's not sure if he has a future. And he asks her to read his past then. But she does not want to lose the mystery around him. But all this time she's speaking in a very coldly detached manner towards him.
Yeah, I remember watching this scene and thinking, you know, Dorian, buddy, every guy has been in your situation. Just cut your losses and leave. You got to know when you're not wanted. You know, but he just keeps pressing the point.
He does.
I don't blame him because, I mean, she left in the middle of sexy time. And, you know, that kind of requires an explanation, yeah. I think. I mean, just to kind of
was
follow.
It the wart on my dick? What
oh,
was it?
Oh, yeah. It could have been that.
Tell me.
Yeah. Was that what was doing it? I mean, you could be honest with me. But yeah, that's just the forms of good taste and common decency kind of dictate that you need to, like, say why you left during the middle of sex, I think.
So he keeps, pressing, and he tells her that he will be waiting at the Rothschild Slipper at 4 o'clock, and she quickly departs without giving him any indication that she will meet him there. Next scene, Ethan prays in Latin over a fast-fading Brona. He exits the inn, and he is being watched by two men. They are not from England. One apparently is Native American. Malcolm Murray is at a weapon shop, and he picks up a weapon that he has special ordered. And I think this weapon is, I don't know if I can pronounce this, the Borchardt C93 pistol. It's a semi-automatic pistol. The place of origin is the German Empire. It was designed in 1893. The specifications, when you look up this gun, match some of the details, like the caliber. I had read somewhere else, another source, where they were thinking it was a Mauser, and I looked up the Mauser, and I don't think it's that.
It's similar to one, it kind of in the general shape of the weapon, but this guy says it's a prototype. So I mean, if it was a Mauser, he probably just would have said it was.
So as he's leaving, he runs into Madame Collie, and she tells him her actual name is Evelyn Poole.
Evelyn, not Evelyn, Evelyn.
You know her name's really Evelyn, and she changed it to Evelyn. I've known a woman named Teresa, and she changed it to Tressa. So
Tressa. And then she tripped over her stack of Anne Rice novels.
she's clearly interested in Malcolm Murray, but not in the way that she is trying to make it seem like she's interested in him.
Yeah, she's sometimes I refer, not on the podcast, but sometimes I refer to Malcolm Murray as Eminem because of his initials. And she's kind of wondering at this point if Eminem's melt in your mouth, not in your hands. It's that kind of interest, people.
Well, that's what she's projecting, but I think her interest is different.
Oh yeah, there's something going on behind that, but.
Definitely. Actually, she looks like a Cheshire cat when she said, "And us just getting reacquainted." And she's lighting her cigarette. He hopes they will meet again, and she is sure of it, and then watches him walk out like she has got something up her sleeve.
Now, let me ask you something. Why do you think when she said, "How is your friend?" and she's kind of playing coy about it, and she's like, she's trying, it seemed to me like she was trying to,
Get information about Ives.
well, to see if they were like an item or something like that. Because he was like, "I don't see much of her. She was a friend of my daughter's."
I think she more wants information about Ives. I think this is setting up next season, and I think we're going to have a lot more about spiritualists.
So you think this lady's the real deal? Because Ives obviously was.
Ives is possessed. This woman's a spiritualist.
Right. But I mean, is she a charlatan or is she the real deal? Is what I'm trying to get at because.
I don't think she's a charlatan because she picked up that Ives was possessed before Ives made it known at the séance. So, but what type of story that's going to generate, we'll see. And we'll talk about casting news at the end. Actually, we'll talk about casting news on our bonus podcast. We'll save it
Yeah,
for
okay.
that. But I'm thinking that there's going to be a lot surrounding the spiritualists, since they're bringing her back in
Should
like
be
that.
interesting.
Yeah, definitely. I'm looking forward to it. So now at the Grand Guignol, things are not going well for Caliban. That dude that I said looked like Paul Rudd, he doesn't. He just has the same haircut that Paul Rudd had in Wet Hot American Summer, but he doesn't really look like him. But his name is Simon, and Maud listens to his namby-pamby ass when, he tells her to come after he has his little temper tantrum. Caliban apologizes to Vincent Brand because of the issues with the line, and Vincent Brand's like, "Whatever, show business, all
Yeah.
bitches."
And not much has changed since then.
And then Maud pays Caliban a visit afterwards, and she brings him an orange, which led me to try to look up the value of an orange, and I couldn't find that information. But when I was trying to figure out the value of this, I discovered that in 1893, Juicy Fruit chewing gum was introduced. Wouldn't it be weird if all these characters were popping Juicy Fruit into their mouths?
And their last fight scene, against the vampires, it could be said, "Juicy fruit is gonna move you."
So she thanks him for the book, but she's not reading it. Not surprised, because she's a dumb bitch.
So she's a dumb blonde, so she can't read. She can barely read her lines. She's like, it's a bit long.
So this shows she does not reciprocate his feelings, in my opinion, the fact that she hasn't really endeavored to read it. But she apologizes on behalf of Simon, and she tells him that he does not have to hide his face from her, that Caliban doesn't have to hide his face from her. She is really nice to him, but he did not get that she was just trying to be his friend. That's what she was doing. And, you know, my experience, guys will sometimes take friendly gestures as flirtation, and that's what she was doing. So
it is a different time period, but she did go and give him a kiss.
She did, on the forehead.
On the forehead. And I think I don't know how things were then, but now I think if there's a guy who has a big crush on a girl and she gives him a kiss on the forehead, you're just throwing the dice there, because he's going to construe that any way that he wants to.
That's true.
You know,
I mean, that would be, I would never kiss anybody
on
the forehead.
A handshake is probably more appropriate. Like, Caliban, we can be friends.
Or just putting a hand on his shoulder.
Yeah, there's a difference between a nice gesture, and this definitely wasn't a sexual gesture.
No.
But this guy has no framework within which to kind of differentiate what's a friendly gesture and what's a come hither type gesture. You know, he looked at this as a green light. And I kind of can't blame him, because he just doesn't have that, you know, he's not socially adept.
Yeah, technically he's what, just a couple years old?
Yeah, because I mean, from what I understand, whenever Frankenstein works on one of these corpses, whoever they used to be as a living individual disappears when they die. That soul goes away to heaven or hell or wherever. And then it's a new beginning for that creature.
It seems to be with Caliban, but with Proteus was getting...
Ah, that's right. Proteus started to remember stuff, so there might be something to that.
So I think that's gonna be some stuff we'll talk about, speculation,
but
for next
at the very
season.
Least, they don't remember social protocol. We can bet on that.
That's true. But she's projecting her feelings that she has for her brother onto him. Mm. So that's why.
I forgot about that. That's a good point. She cares about her brother who was, his face was damaged in a fire, so...
Right. So now we're back with Ives, and she confronts Malcolm Murray about why Malcolm Murray did not want her on the ship. She wants to know about what he has not told her, and he tells her that if he has to, he will sacrifice her to save Mina. He would choose Mina over her and may even hope to get the chance.
Wow.
Yeah, that was unnecessary, that last part.
Yeah.
Really?
That was harsh. That was really harsh, especially after the way he had treated her in the previous episode. You know, when she had that moment of lucidity and she's tied to the bed and he comes up and he's just looming over her face, like going, you've got this rare opportunity, find Mina. And she's like, you're being so cruel. I mean, how can you be that cruel to another human being in that state? You know, but all he cares about is just his one single focus of finding his daughter.
Yeah, I have some things to say about that when we get to the end here.
But they were just snapping on each other left and right. It's just like, it's almost like they had a bottle of Snapple and they were passing it back and forth. Here you go. No, it's your turn. It's your turn.
No, you deserve this. He tells her that she needs to handle her guilt on her own, and she leaves him with some food for thought when she's like, because he's saying that he doesn't...
Both of them are looking... Well, no, both of them are guilty, but the difference between the two of them is he's not looking for any sort of absolution from his guilt.
He's saying his is a manly guilt, and hers is guilt of a child woman. And then she's like, well, if that's so, you then put the photograph back on your table then.
Yeah, what did he say? Looking at the photograph broke my heart, and that's a man's heart, not a girl's heart.
Yeah, exactly.
Which is, it's a dick thing to say.
Yeah, he's saying his like feelings are more profound than hers, basically.
Yeah, and it's harder to break his heart because he's not some wishy-washy little girl. I felt like he was trying to say that.
There's a
too.
Lot there. Yeah, it's misogynistic too. Like, girl feelings are, you know, trifling.
It's all hysterics. It's all period talk. You know.
So Caliban makes himself up like Robert Smith, so he can go.
This is Robert Smith wearing Oshkosh Bagosh overalls.
And then he's got the kerchief around his neck like he's a little boy playing cowboys and Indians.
Yeah, I felt horribly bad for him in this scene.
And he goes and pays Maud a visit. She laughs when she sees him and asks, what have you done to yourself? She tells him that he should not be in her dressing room and tells him to leave, and he tries to kiss her and keeps trying to forcefully, even though obviously she's just fighting him off. He grabs her by the face and slams her up against that pylon. What is that?
Yeah, it's some part of the support structure of the stage.
Anyway, he gets sacked for this. Vincent Brand would rather fire her, but the public would be unhappy because they love the ingenue. Caliban thanks Bran for his show of kindness, and Bran hugs him and says, "Remember us better than we are."
I like that when he says that. Remember
I do
us
too.
better than we are. That's a but going back to the scene, like when he's, you know, talking to her and he wants to share the orange and everything. What's her boyfriend's name?
Simon.
Simon. She's like, "You shouldn't be in here." And he goes, "Simon comes in here." And she's like, "How do you know that?" Because, you know, she's unaware that he has this method of spying on them because he knows all the little rat holes and everything around the place.
Well, behind him, the grate is actually lit up. There's light coming from the inside of the grate out.
So that's just got to creep her out. I can imagine that just being like, you know, and somebody tells you like something that they shouldn't know about your private life. That's creepy.
And she's like in her like lingerie, equivalent of lingerie at the time or whatever.
Right.
And she reaches to go grab a robe to cover herself. And that's when he lunges for her and he keeps lunging.
Yeah, that's creepy too.
Yeah, very. So... yeah, so he is sacked, and before he departs, he kind of looks at the theater as like a last goodbye, and then the camera pans up, and we see a sleeping vampire, and those vampires sleep more than cats, because I just finished Bram Stoker's, too, and they sleep a lot in there.
It's just like vampires are the lazy bones of the monster world. They don't really do anything. They're never, you know.
They sleep, and then they get up, and they want to feed,
mm-hmm.
and then they sleep some more. You know, I don't mind some of the modernization, you know, of vamps these days, where they actually have these interesting, glamorous lives. The old-school vamps, some of it, not too appealing.
It's a double-edged sword. I mean, I understand the modernization because it makes them more interesting.
Mm-hmm.
You know, but this old-school way of looking at them makes them seem like more
monsters.
Of a creation of nature. You know, they're nature's monster. And, you know, lots of animals are just lazy pieces of crap that don't really contribute anything, you know.
Speak for yourself.
Yeah. Of course, I mean, I try to think of how my day would be ordered if I had no responsibilities or no bills to pay or anything, and I'd probably sleep like a cat. So
probably at least five naps.
At least.
Yeah.
At least.
So now Ives does show up at Rothschild's slipper after all, and the bloom has fallen. Well, I think this is showing, has the bloom fallen off their relationship in question marks?
It's a bit of a heavy-handed metaphor.
It is.
Because we get not one but two close-ups of this orchid that is now droopy when the last time we saw it, it was in full bloom.
It's crispy.
It's crispy, yeah. And withered.
But I hope it's not. And she tells him that she is not the woman he thinks she is, and that their intimacy relieves something in her she cannot allow. He almost looks like this child, and he doesn't know what he's feeling, and she tells him that he's feeling rejection. And when she departs, he wipes a tear from his eye, and he looks at it quizzically like, I can
What is
cry?
This? Yeah. What's going on here? All of their conversations that they've had ever since they met at Zidler's party were... they're pretty much just filled with this repartee, this back and forth, where things aren't actually said explicitly. They're kind of implied. Or if they are said explicitly, it's done in a very poetic manner. And I think this conversation follows suit with that. And she tells him, "We're breaking up," you know,
yeah.
without just saying, "Listen, I'm possessed by a demon. And whenever we start to get the sexy time on, that demon's going to come out. And it's going to be bad news for everybody. So we're done." You know, but that just, you can't say that poetically, so she did the best she could. But she was pretty, like, I don't know how you'd say it, like, she bookended that. There's no question about it. She said goodbye, Dorian, you know, or Mr. Gray. I forgot which one she said.
Yeah, she cut the cord completely.
Mm-hmm.
No strings attached anymore. She just...
So you're saying there's a chance. Yeah, you're not going to get any of that.
Do you think that something, the fact that he's never felt rejection before and he's feeling it now, that it makes her more intriguing?
Oh, I'm sure. I'm sure, because he's a hedonist for one, but I think he's a hunter after new experiences, mm-hmm. and new ways to feel. And this rejection is, he doesn't look like gobsmacked by it like some people would, you know. He sees the tear and he's like, "What is this? This is something new," you know. So he's going to face this with like it's a fresh new day of experience. And
where a contact.
Yeah, I didn't think of that. The cut scenes on the DVD will show, you know, like, oh, damn, damn it.
He's like, "Wait, nobody move."
I lost the contact.
Like Daryl Hannah and Steel Magnolias. So now we're moving on to Caliban. He has sought out Victor, which I didn't think that was surprising that he sought out Victor, I guess.
I would have liked to seen a little bit more of the preamble of this scene, because when we come into it, it's showing us the outside of Victor's abode, and then, you know, we get the inside, and he's like, you can't stay here. And then you see Caliban, and he's just like, I don't intend to. But, like, how did this happen? You know, Victor's just kind of doing whatever he's doing. Like, I pictured him, like, standing in front of the mirror, you know, pulling the gun out of the holster, and, you know, like, you talking to me? You talking to me? You know, like Robert De Niro in Taxi Driver.
He probably has been doing
it. You know, and then he hears this knock on the door, and he's just like, ah, who is it? And then he goes and gets the door, and it's, you know, it's your buddy Caliban.
So Victor says he has not forgiven him for Van Helsing.
He says that his heart is not big enough to forgive him for killing Van Helsing. But I think that, you know, that Frankenstein was speaking for the viewer in that scene, because we've gone back and forth with Caliban as far as how we feel about him. We feel sorry for him, then we feel enraged toward him, and then it kind of comes back to this middle ground of like, ah, I feel bad for the guy, but I also hate him in some ways, you know, because of what he did to Proteus and then what he did to Van Helsing. So it's just like speaking on our behalf, saying there's not enough room in our hearts to forgive you, but we'll see how this goes.
And then Caliban has given up on his mate, saying it is all futile because the monster is not in his face, but in his soul.
That affects Victor in a way, I think, because he's got a gun pointed at his head at this point.
He talks of how the malignance has grown from the outside in. It's actually a really touching speech. And it's very eloquent, way he speaks. And it's interesting because I know Caliban is supposed to be kind of like Victor's dark side manifest. And so are his poetical leanings. They're found in Caliban because he's, you know, kind of decided that his he's been cursed or haunted by poets that he read as a child, that they, you know what I mean?
Oh.
So it's kind of gone over into Caliban, which is interesting.
That's a good point. I never really thought about that, because he talks about, remember he talked to Van Helsing when they had lunch right before, you know, Caliban does him in. He says that he suffers from his expectations of romance and life are a little bit high because he's cursed to read good poetry mm-hmm. in his youth, basically, more or less. And so Caliban can kind of be seen as a manifestation of that. That's interesting.
I think right when he says, why couldn't you made me of steel instead of, you know, giving me feelings, is what really affected Victor the most. So instead he puts his hand on Caliban's shoulders, and then Ethan knocks at the door.
Did you see the look on Caliban's face when Victor places his hand on his shoulder?
Yeah.
It's just like, it's, I don't know.
Daddy?
Yeah. It was just like, oh my God, my creator has some sort of approval for me. Because as much as he's called him a demon, and as much as he's, you know, rained down his wrath on him and killed people that he's loved, I think he does want his approval. I think he does want that, you know, what he was getting from, God damn, I always forget that guy's name, the guy at the theater.
Vincent Brand.
Yeah, Vincent. What he was getting from Vincent, he really wanted from Frankenstein. So
Ethan's about to cry, and Victor is actually teary-eyed at the door, but neither of them see that in each other because they're both trying to look away. But Ethan tells Victor that he needs him. So now they're with Brona. Victor offers a sedative, and then he tries to calm her down about death, and he talks to her about how it's like stepping through a door, which is reflective of what his mother was trying to say to him before she died about death when his dog had died. Then Victor pulls Ethan aside and tells him it won't be long and to go and fetch a basin of water. Victor tells her about the place between heaven and hell. He tells her there is a price to pay, like there is for all things, and he knows that she will pay for it easily. And this is when he smothers her with a pillow.
So what do you think he's saying right there?
Well, when he talked about the place between heaven and hell, he's talking about Caliban and Proteus, what he's created. But it also, it's similar to what Ives has talked about with the Demimonde, the half-world, the place where things like that exist. But Victor doesn't know about the Demimonde.
Yeah, true. He
hasn't been talked to about the half-world that Ives has talked to Ethan about.
So he's speaking almost in a scientific sense, really.
He's just speaking of his own experience. He's speaking of that place between life and death that he wants to pierce, that he was talking to, you know, Malcolm Murray about when they were at the Explorers Club.
Okay. Yeah, I can see that.
So Ethan comes back and Victor looks guilty. Ethan, of course, doesn't see it because Victor tells him that, sorry, she's gone. Victor gives him his condolences. He says her passing was a thing of grace and that he will take care of her body. Victor then leaves Ethan with her and Ethan weeps.
Now, we know that Victor wanted the body for, what he's going to do with it later, but and that's part of the reason why he, put the pillow over her face and, snuffed her out. Do you think there was also a little bit of compassion in that because his mother died of consumption and she was just coughing up blood at the end and it was completely horrible and everybody was just nursing her to her death.
Yeah,
So,
I think you're right about that.
yeah.
So next, Ethan's walking the streets and he ends up at a bar crying and drinking. The two yahoos from the beginning that have been following Ethan, and they approach him finally, and they are employed by the Pinkerton Agency, which I read a little bit about that. It's a detective agency that was kind of a federal institution, and a lot of times they are employed to work out labor disputes or to infiltrate things like that.
So they
And
were like union busters.
pretty much, I mean, when I read it, and maybe it has a lot to do with my politics, but it just sounds like an agency of dickheads. I didn't really see anything that made me go, wow, these guys are
Yeah, these
awesome.
guys are great.
So they talk about how they miss America, ice chips and cherry phosphates, and they want to take Ethan home in chains to his father. So I guess they're his father's employed them too. Makes me wonder who his father is. If he fights, they will drag him back like a monkey. And this is the first time they call him a monkey.
They're pretty sure of themselves, and the Indian puts the chains up on the table like he's just like, "Yep, this is what's in store for you if you fight us." But they're bad at their job. They're horrible at their job because if you're a professional bounty hunter and you're sent to go get somebody, I mean, I don't do this as a profession, so I'm not talking from experience, just from a common sense observation. Rule number one has to be don't underestimate your prey, and that's what they did all day long. They even say so after they get their asses thoroughly kicked. But I mean, why would you do that in the first place?
I bet they were given a dossier on Ethan and they didn't bother to read it.
Well, they have chains. I
They were
mean,
given the chains too at the same time. They're like, here's some chains, read this. If I was given chains and a dossier on somebody, I would read that fucking dossier and like, why the fuck do I need this chain, these
Well,
like chains
handcuffs existed back then, I'm pretty sure.
and
So,
rope?
and rope, yeah, and things like that. So, why were chains necessary? I mean, that's a valid question. Yeah, I would have asked for more money, and I would have asked for an explanation, but like you said, they probably got a dossier and they either can't read or they just threw it away or whatever. They wrapped their lunch in it or something.
They thought this pansy rich fucker will be easy to catch. And I think Ethan has been in a lot of bar fights because his favorite move is to bust one in the face with a glass.
I am not a violent person. I hope that, yeah, I hope that I never get into a fight because I don't want to be hurt, number one, and I don't want to seriously hurt anybody if I don't have to. But having said all that, if it ever comes down to it and I'm in a bar, I'm totally using that move. And if I knock someone out, I'm just going to stand over him. You just got Ethan. Then I'm going to throw some change on the right up on the bar like Han Solo and just
And
walk out.
just stroll out.
Stroll out.
Yeah. So he deals with those assholes for now, and the Apache is told to go track Ethan since he's an Apache.
Whoa, racist much?
Just so you know, phosphate
I was
is
wondering about
it's a
that.
soda, which I knew it was a soda, but I just wanted to double check, and it has a tangier sour taste, and it was actually popular among men only in the 1870s, and but they were made with fruit flavorings, egg, malt, or wine. And it wasn't until the 1900s that the beverages became popular with both genders. And so this is kind of the early form of soda.
Interesting now that we call it soda or soft drink, or in some parts of the country you call it pop, and they called it phosphate, because phosphate sounds much more like a chemical than it is.
Which, phosphorus is in the soda still, and it's very bad for you. It leaches calcium from your bones. So, FYI.
Don't drink too much soda, kiddies.
So Ethan meets with Ives out in the snow. They smoke some ganja, and she tells him that she is sorry about Miss Croft. So she's been a pothead this whole time.
So you believe that that is weed? Because it makes sense. Like, because the first time that the first time I saw the scene, you know, she pulls out what looks like a cigarette. And we've seen several instances of her smoking something throughout the series. And she offers it to him. And he says, I don't take that tobacco. And she says, well, neither do I. And so I guess we're to assume that it's weed, you know, and he takes a toke and then he's about to hand it back. She's like, no, go ahead, have another one. Apparently marijuana has demon repelling qualities, and that's why it's so attractive to her.
If I was possessed by a demon, I would not smoke marijuana. But I'm one of those people, it makes me paranoid, so that would just be worse than hell, because it's already hell if you got a demon in you, and then you have to have the paranoia, like, amplified. That would suck.
Look at it like this. What have you got to lose? Whatever's affecting you is going to affect it.
If I don't smoke, I have something to gain, is the way I look at it. Like, not to be as paranoid.
Okay, I can go there with you.
So, now Malcolm Murray, Victor, and Benny arrive, and it's time to head to the theater. Malcolm Murray says that Mina is his responsibility. Nobody else is to handle her.
I think he's doing this to allay everybody's fears that this isn't going to be an exercise in futility. Like, he's saying, I'm not going to get you all killed just so, you know, I can try to get to my daughter, you know what I mean, and then have her be a vampire anyway and be on redemption. I'll take care of business. Because it's already been brought up to him by Ethan in a certain way. It's been brought up to him by Senbenny in a certain way and by Ives. So
I think it's more of a metaphorical thing, because I think Mina is his personal demon. So that's why he wants to deal with her on her own, on his own.
That's better. I like that.
And I'll talk a little bit more about that later. So they search the dark and closed theater. They have some flashlights. I had to look up the flashlights because they're not really, well, yeah. If these are the flashlights that the Ever Ready flashlights I think they're using, these didn't come out till 1899. So there's some confusion with the timeline here, because I did type when was Penny Dreadful set, and apparently one source said 1891. So.
And these flashlights didn't appear until 6 years later?
More like
eight years, sorry.
Yeah. Because that gun doesn't appear until 1893, if that's the actual gun.
Huh. But, I mean, you know, it could be 1901. You know, you never know.
Yeah.
So
I don't really care. I mean, they can play fast and loose with that stuff. I like seeing all these contraptions and stuff that they used at that time. I like it for the setting. So anyway, they have these, and Ives is close at Malcolm Murray's heels as they search, and they spy the male vamp up top, sleeping still. And they take aim, but are thwarted by some of the platinum vamps. Ethan is actually dropped down into the trapdoor.
Wait, before we go on, there was a funny scene that happened before that, because when they're walking in and Ethan is next to Victor and Victor pulls out his gun, you know what I mean? Like, he's the gunslinger. And Ethan just pushes his hand down and he's just like, you don't need to be doing that right now.
Not yet, grasshopper.
Eager beaver.
So Ethan drops down that trap door that was opened by the platinum vamps, and he's having a shoot, and Senbenny jumps down there to help him out. Victor decides not to do that.
He like, takes the steps.
I'm going to go find the steps, because I know there are some.
you got to know what you're up for. You got to know your limitations. He wasn't going to be, he's not a physical guy, so he just took the steps, and it was prudent.
Well, you kind of got to test your boundaries to find out where they actually lie, because he eventually ends up bashing a skull in. He did pretty good. Mm-hmm. He gets attacked. And Benny does have to help him at first, but later on he gets attacked again. And
he does shoot one of them, too.
Yeah, he does.
They made a pretty easy target because they were running straight at him. But
they do that. They just run straight at you.
They're very one-dimensional in their fighting style. I'm going to scream.
And their appearance.
I'm going to scream, and then I'm going to run at you.
They all look exactly alike. So Malcolm Murray takes on I'm going to call him the male vampire, because he is not the master.
Right.
And I just hate him. I mean, he's creepy. They did a good job with the prosthetics and everything like that. But his like serpentine movements that he does with his shoulders, I don't know why.
It reminds me of Pumpkinhead a little bit. I don't know if you remember that movie.
I remember that. It scared me.
Yeah. Pumpkinhead kind of moved like that. He was really skeletally gaunt, and he would, in certain parts of his body anyway, and he would move in that kind of like shoulders first type of way. Yeah. I think it's done to unnerve the viewer. It doesn't
unnerve me.
It's just annoying. Yeah.
Yeah.
I guess it's failing with you, but I see what they're going for.
Yeah. So Ethan and somebody are close to being overwhelmed when Malcolm Murray finally stakes the male vamp. Then the platinum vamps, they fall away. Where'd they go?
They just fell down. Because I thought that they fell away into nothingness, but they fall to the floor.
But then, you know, later on, you don't really see them.
Well, I think that's because they moved to an area where they weren't concentrated at. Because if you notice, everybody, when Mina comes into the scene, everybody moves back to center stage.
Huh.
Because it's right over the trapdoor and stuff like that. And you see the other, like, Victor, Ethan, and Sembeni walking away walking towards that area from another area.
Maybe they just all fell through a trapdoor.
Possibly, yeah. It's possible. But they gave that the male vampire the old 1-2 slip that they did in the very first episode, because they used Ives as bait, and they knew that this vampire was going to, like, sense the evil in her and just be like, why are you here causing havoc? You should, you know, I should be bowing down to you or something like that or whatever, and or saving you for the master, more like, and then Malcolm Murray comes in and skewers him, this time from the front rather than from the behind, from behind.
And he finally, you know, completes the deed when he has to turn the stake in his heart. So, yeah, the platinum vamps disappear. Mina's voice is heard calling for Vanessa. She embraces Ives, but Mina is not really Mina. She holds Ives as hostage. Mina wants to bring them all to join the master, now that he has his bride.
And she's nibbling erotically on her ear.
And rubbing on her belly, too, yeah. On Ives' belly.
Talking about how the master's going to sire generations on her.
Yeah. And this is when Malcolm Murray takes aim, and he shoots her. Mina falls to the ground, and she says, but I am your daughter. And he says he already has a daughter, and he shoots her again. You know, she could have, like, at least tried to change her eyes back to, like, Mina's eyes instead of having the vamp eyes if she was trying to manipulate him. Like,
I wonder why they didn't do that, because that's a common thing. That's a pretty common trope, because whenever there's a monster or demon that can take human form or has taken human form as a host, they change back to the familiar face to try to, like, get people to be more comfortable around them and say, it's okay, it's me, you know, I'm all right, and then tricked you.
So back at Malcolm Murray's house, Malcolm Murray says they should get a Christmas tree, and Ives says that the boys should come over to decorate. Okay, it was much more touching than what I wrote, but
yeah.
You know, Malcolm Murray is very upset, taking down his maps, and you know, you're right, I was never going to go to Africa, and he cries, and Ives embraces him, and it's a very touching moment for both of them, for us as viewers.
Yeah, I felt like this was his redemption, because he's been a prick all season long.
Yeah, what I was going to say is that Mina's kind of served throughout the season as a reminder to Malcolm Murray about his failure as a father. She's really...
And as a husband.
Yeah, and she was never really savable, even though we thought or hoped that she was. Van Helsing pretty much said that as much, right?
Van Helsing told us, he informed us as the viewer of that, but when do you think that he became cognizant of that fact? When do you think that it sunk in for him?
I don't know. Maybe not till then. Moment.
Like right there when he had to shoot her?
Yeah, or... I don't know. But he had to face his failure with Mina/Peter to get some closure and to save the only salvageable relationship he had from his past, and that's Vanessa. So shooting Mina was the way for him to deal with those demons, that demon.
And, you know, he says, I already have a daughter. And, like, this is all speculation on my part, but I still think that that could be literally true.
Yeah, we may still find that out.
Because I don't feel like the first time that we see him having sex with Ives' mother, you know, is the first time that he actually had sex with her. But it's neither here nor there for now.
So Victor and Caliban work on Brona. No words are spoken this entire scene.
Well, you had mentioned something about that scene, and I was just going to say, because, you know, it's unlikely to see the bride before the wedding. So it's...
It made me think of, some lore says that Adam had 3 wives, and one of them he actually saw made in front of him, and he couldn't bear to touch her or anything like that, so God had to unmake her again and give him another wife. So I was just like, Caliban, what are you doing? Why are you watching? He's got his hand over his heart, like it's the most touching thing he's ever seen.
It probably is.
It's a gift from his dad.
Yeah.
So,
Well,
as grotesque as it is.
if he can stop killing people that he loves, you know.
So now Ethan's drinking at an inn, and he's watching, and it's at the same inn actually, because he's watching the boats out the window doing his maritime supervision.
His unpaid profession.
Yeah. And the Pinkerton dicks are back. And they call him a monkey a couple more
Yeah.
times.
The Indian has his hand on his pistol this time. They're ready. Or they
Yeah,
think they
they
are.
think they are.
Yeah.
And so he's just like, no, not a monkey. And I
Well,
love this scene.
he says that to me, the best part of the, not the best part of the scene, the whole scene's great, but they say, okay, the fun's over. And he's like, what does he say? Is that so?
Yeah.
He's just asking, is that so? And then
You think
something
so?
is going to happen, but I don't know what. And then, bam, we
Right when you
finally get
saw
to
his
see it.
fingers start to change, were you convinced?
Yeah, that's when I knew it. And when he says, "No, I'm not a monkey," it sounds like he's talking through like a mask. Like his vocal and facial configuration has changed, so the intonation of his voice is different. I was like, "Uh-oh, here we go."
So, does he kill everyone in that inn?
I'm thinking that he did. On when I watched it the first time, I thought that he did, and then the second time I saw it, I was trying to listen because after you see him kill those two guys, the Pinkerton guys, it just shows you the window with the blood stain on it.
It could have still been them screaming.
It could have just been them screaming, yeah. But this leads me to believe that Ethan was responsible for all of these other deaths
So you're saying the little girl at the beginning, he's responsible for.
and the mother.
I have a hard time. I don't want to believe that.
Okay, I think the writers are leaving it. They leave a lot of stuff untied at the end of this season. So I don't believe that Ethan did that because Ethan's a really good character and he has a really good heart, but he may not be completely in control of himself when he becomes this wolf man.
I know, and everybody has their dark side, but that would be so dark.
It really would. But I think this is one of the plot threads that could just be left untidied up, and it's going to follow into the next season, and there's going to be more killings, and maybe he'll come under suspicion by, say, like Malcolm Murray or somebody else as the perpetrator of these crimes, but it's going to be shown that he's not, hopefully.
So, all right, we're not sure if he killed everybody at that inn. We'll talk more about it here in the speculation section. Ives visits a priest at the church that we've seen her watch before from a distance on that bench where she talked to that creepy little girl. Meanwhile, Malcolm Murray has accepted his personal demons, I think, his children, that he places their photograph up on his desk. Ethan has awoken outdoors again. We also see, don't we see Victor in Caliban once more at this point? And so this is kind of like a montage that's showing everyone is dealing with their curses in a way. And in fact, Ives says that she believes in curses, demons, and monsters. Curse being Ethan, demons being herself, monsters being Frankenstein. I thought that
That's really
interesting.
good. I didn't catch that.
And so she speaks with this priest and tells him basically that she wants an exorcism. And he talks of his experience with, exorcism in Wales. The priest asks her if, or well, he says, being possessed by a demon is kind of like having the backhand of God, being struck by the backhand of God, makes her sacred in a way. And he asks, "Are you sure you want to be normal?" And I swear, like his eye that was in the shadow, because one was in the light and the other eye was kind of in a shadow. I think it was his actual right eye. It was almost starting to turn dark. I'm like, would a priest actually say that to someone? Are you sure you want to do this?
I don't know. It does seem like an odd question, but I think that by this point in time, exorcisms had become less and less frequent. And because, modern science was starting to catch up with things as far as, like, because even the priest said himself, he said, "I believe in illnesses that are treatable." And that's when she kind of said, "Well, what happens when that fails?" And now you're talking about exorcism and
So
stuff.
he's
So,
saying then, and letting her just continue the way she is would be better than an exorcism.
because it's not guaranteed to work, it doesn't always have the intended
So wouldn't it
outcome.
amount to the same thing?
No, it wouldn't, because sometimes the outcome can be worse. Sometimes you create it. It's like opening a Pandora's
Like a
box of
psychological thing?
psychological and spiritual energies and powers that you don't know how to control or understand. And so You remember there was a, I know I keep going back to The Exorcist, but there's a scene in the, you know, she says, Reagan says, "What an excellent day for an exorcism." And Father Karras says, "You'd like that? You know, that would bring us closer." And she's like, "You and Reagan?" He says, "You and us." So they, what does that mean? You know what I mean? I don't know, but
It's creepy.
it's creepy, and it's very, it's foreboding, and it's dark, and it's kind of like you don't really know what's going to go on. So I think, and then there's also a point where Father Karras tells Chris McNeil that it could do more harm than good, you know. But I don't know if he's necessarily taking that route, but I think he is, in a certain sense, trying to tell her that if we go with this, it could take forever. It might not even work. This might not be what you need. But are you willing to give up the uniqueness? And there was a conversation earlier about the uniqueness between her and Dorian Gray. And I think it touches back to
Right,
that a
it
little bit.
does.
So, and I think, and this could, I could talk about this more in the speculation section, or I could say it now, either one, but.
Let me just say, okay, the episode ends with her thinking hard about this question.
Yeah, we don't get any closure on that,
No,
which I think
we
is
don't.
awesome. We don't know if Ethan killed those guys. We don't know if, or we know he killed those two guys, but we don't know if he killed the other patrons and workers in the bar. We don't know what happens with the Brona Bride of Frankenstein, and we don't know what Vanessa Ives' answer to that question was. And I think that's all great. I think it's really good storytelling, and it sets a good platform up for season
Yeah,
two.
I'm excited.
Yeah, so I'm figuring, as far as speculation is concerned, I think the reason why they left her answer to this question unanswered is because that's her special power. That's what she brings to the group. She has this darkness within her that's allowed her to kind of, I don't know, echolocate Mina at certain times. And there's got to be other stuff to it. It's not just that. So it's this special darkness that's going to be what she brings to the table for their further adventures, I think. So I think you're, I don't think the season two is going to open up with her going no to the priest, but I think we're going to understand through context that she turned down that offer.
So she's probably going to spend next season working on control, like being able to suppress it and still be able to use it to her advantage.
Yeah, I think so. Yeah.
What I was saying about Ethan earlier, I don't want to believe that he killed that little girl, her mother, that prostitute. So I thought about it a lot, and I'm thinking that maybe there's another werewolf, a werewolf he's followed from America, maybe he's responsible for, and this person has gone dark in some way, some sort of renegade werewolf, and so he has to deal with that. And maybe that's who's been doing,
That's a good point. I didn't think anything like
maybe
that,
he's
but
hunting him or her or whatever.
yeah, that
Yeah.
would be a good twist if it was a female.
Yeah, and so yeah, maybe it's a
A former love interest or
or a
something.
sister.
Or a sister, yeah.
Sister.
Sister. So yeah, that's a really good idea. That would be pretty awesome.
Yeah.
But I mean, he had
And they'll
but
think it's him at first, but then he'll have to reveal his past and be like, "No, it's not me.
The
This
only
is
thing,
Stitch."
yeah, the only thing that I could say to be counter to that, not that I really want to be, is that like he didn't really, there wasn't any plot threads in this season that had him following a trail. You know, he spent most of his alone time drinking, and then he kind of became involved with the group, and then did whatever Malcolm Murray needed him to do.
Yeah, that's true.
So there would have at least been an hint or an allusion to him searching for somebody at some point. It doesn't mean they can't work that into it. Or this could just be some other thing
Maybe it's the
altogether.
real reason why he watches the boats out there. Who knows?
Yeah.
Maybe there's some other reason why he watches those boats.
Yeah.
I know I'm reaching for straws here, but I.
But I think it's probably most likely a third thing altogether. It's like some other monster that could be like the instead of having one big bad per season, this is like the overarching kind of theme. And the big bad this season was the whole Mina and vampire storyline.
Back to Ives. So the Egyptologist had said that Amunet had a demon within her. That so I don't think the demon within Ives is Amun-Ra,
Okay.
because it keeps referring to the master vampire as wanting to make Ives his bride, because Mina said that. So the master vampire that we have not yet met is Amun-Ra.
Okay.
So that's what I think.
But it, she still wouldn't be Amunet because that's the female side. And whenever she was possessed in the one episode, and it took the form of Ethan and was talking to her and was saying, I want you to be my bride and rule with me if she's going to be the bride. So,
okay. Well, so what about Victor, Caliban, and Brona?
This situation is going to get ugly. It's going to be bad. I'm really excited to see what the FX people who have done a super great job on this show. Congratulations to them. But
yeah.
I'm really interested to see like how they make her look. I mean, I don't think they're going to give her the big
shock of hair.
Shock of hair like Marge Simpson or anything like that, you know, like the old Bride of Frankenstein movies. But there could be some sort of nod to that in the way that they do her hair. Who knows?
Yeah.
We'll see. But all of these characters, with the possible exception of Dorian Gray, we don't know what's going to happen with him because he's always been an outsider anyway. He's the one character I could see just being a one-season type person. I'm not saying that's going to happen. I'm just saying I could see it. But all these characters are going to interact again on some level, and Caliban's going to have to be brought into the mix, and then Ethan's going to see Brona at some point. And how this is going to be explained and the newly formed friendship that I really like between Ethan and Victor could dissolve into some ass kicking real quick.
I wonder if Ethan needs to, or I mean, Victor needs to get the gun training down.
Oh, he's got a long way to go to be a quick draw like Ethan, but there'll be some good stories to be told there.
Mm-hmm.
And I have no clue. Nothing really leads me to believe everything was, you know, left so open-ended that nothing really leads me to believe that the story is going to go in one specific direction versus another. And that's kind of exciting because it could just be anything.
You think Brona is going to take to Caliban? I don't.
You know what would be interesting if Brona takes to Victor. And then you've got this love triangle going on.
Hmm.
And, you know, at that point, Victor's fulfilled his, you know, what he said he was going to do for Caliban, but he can't control how she feels. Yeah, and we have already made it abundantly clear to us that Victor is a virgin. So there's going to be, I don't know, that's just what I'm thinking.
And what about Malcolm Murray?
I don't know. He's the wild card in all this. He seems to be the one who has the most kind of like cleanly snipped off storyline at this point. I have no doubt he's going to be in the next season.
Except Madame Callie.
Oh, yeah,
has
okay,
her
yeah.
On him.
Maybe that's not so cut and dried then. I'm not really sure what's going to happen there. I am glad that the Mina storyline did find its resolution in this season because it just didn't feel like something that could bear the weight of being dragged into another season and keep our interest.
Yeah, I agree. So let's go into feedback.
Okay. We got a really nice letter from Mike Spa, Hot Tub. And he says, can Steve explain why Vanessa is in this extremely vulnerable state? She is constantly in and out of possession and reality during this week or so, and I am not entirely sure why she can fight off the possession most times and why she can't at this time. This letter was written before the final episode. He was referring to the penultimate episode, Possession. It could just be how the writer wants it to be, but I would like to know if there is more to this. In conjunction with this, when exactly was she possessed? I believe you made mention of that during the pod when we knew she was possessed, but I don't recall that. Okay, to answer, there's a little bit more and I'll read that next, but I'm just going to answer this question first. And I believe that she has moments of strength and lucidity somewhat similar to anybody who's suffering from an illness, say like the flu. You know what I mean? Sometimes you're just down and out. Sometimes you can get up and walk around. So it's not always completely one way or the other. That's why she seems vulnerable at certain times and not so vulnerable at others. And that's just an assumption on my part. I'm no authority on these things, but just from my vast knowledge of watching movies, sitting on my ass, that's what I come up with. And she was, as far as to when exactly she was possessed, I would say that, to sum it up, I believe she was probably carrying the demonic entity around with her ever since the night that she saw her mother and Murray having sex out in the bush maze or the hedge maze. And it was in her in a sort of like passive sense.
She saw it and she liked it and probably had some guilt feeling as that.
Right.
And then that opened the door.
Well, because that night she prayed to God and God didn't answer, but another voice did.
That wasn't that night, but
to around that period of time,
right.
You know, and then she was under its influence to a greater extent during the period after Mina's departure. Whenever they weren't friends anymore, after the scene where she sleeps with her fiance and things like that, and Murray tells her that, you know, that all this has happened because of a cruel little girl. And then she faints and everything. And I think she's under the influence of this demonic entity a little bit more during that and during the whole scenes where she goes to the asylum and things like that. And it starts to manifest itself more and more and more. But the treatment was worse than the illness in this case. And they put her in such a state that she had to strike a bargain with this demonic entity. And this is when she became possessed in earnest for the first time. And that's where her mother comes in. And she has just the whites of her eyes showing. And she's basically having sex with the demon, and that's its way of egress to enter her and take her completely. But it was like it's the veritable striking a deal with the devil.
Right.
She was able to, as we saw at the end of that episode, come back to a sense of normalcy, and there's a lot of time that elapsed, so there's a lot more story to be told in that gap. But she was able to find a balance between being herself and being the possessed Vanessa. And that balance is thrown out of whack whenever she hooks up with Dorian Gray, because her triggers are sex and guilt. And I think she feels both of these things when she's with Dorian Gray, because she feels so guilty about what happened to Mina, as in it's her fault. And that's the guilt part. And then the sex part is when the demon comes in, because I think it's all intertwined with the psychosexuality of it, for lack of a better term.
I think sex and guilt are linked for her.
Yes, definitely, definitely. And
So.
so whenever she has that tryst with Dorian Gray, that's when the demon comes out, and that's when it's full-fledged, and it found its way in past her defenses. So it wasn't passively this dark passenger anymore. It was now actively in control. And then that's where we get the full-bore possession going on. And then Hot Tub goes on to write, "With regards to Senbene and his story arc, I believe that his story will be a long, slow drip. He is a peripheral player, and I believe his story lends itself to a long game type arc. I don't want to know all his secrets. I like being surprised by his cat killing, food critic, and smack a bitch self." What do you think about Senbene?
Well, it makes me go, wait, we didn't even talk about Senbene in our speculation, because his character, I mean, we haven't seen much of him. We didn't even think to speculate on what he's going to bring to the next
They
season.
just don't give you much to go on. But I agree with Mike here that I want, and when I wrote him back in an email, I told him as much, that I'm like perfectly happy with seeing a little bit here and a little bit there. I really don't want to see one episode where they show us everything about his past and then secrets revealed. Now he's just a normal character. It's
Right.
like I want to keep that mystique. He says, "And last but not least, Ethan. I am torn between Ethan and Vanessa as to which character I like more. Van is so in your face, beautiful, ugly, shallow, deep, and beloved." That's a really good description of her. "Ethan is much more controlled, or even pretty, consistent in his Americanism, deep and layered." I don't know if he meant pretty consistent or pretty comma consistent. He wrote pretty comma, but I'm not sure if he's pretty consistent or if he thinks he's pretty.
He might think Ethan's
Yeah,
pretty.
we'll just go with both. How about that? "Ethan plays right into the person I am, while Van plays into the person I would like to be. I say that I would like to be like Vanessa, not like to possess Vanessa, obviously." Now, you said Ethan is your favorite character?
Yes, because I was in the same hot tub where I wasn't sure who was my favorite, Vanessa or Ethan. And this is probably could be temporary, but it was confirmed for me after watching this for the second time. When I saw him wielding that axe is when I was like, yeah, he's my favorite character. And it's probably my baser nature superseding all reason maybe, but I'm fine with that
Because
for
it was
now.
hot.
I don't know. And then when he turns into the werewolf is just so badass.
Yeah,
They
that
did
really
a really
was.
good job with that. So
It wasn't overdone.
no,
It
it was
was
a
really,
light touch.
yeah, and but it was evil looking. Like he
Yeah.
was, you're gonna get killed if
Yeah,
you
when his
see
fingers
that.
started to change, I was like, oh shit.
I think there was a tiny little bit of an homage to An American Werewolf in London there
Which I
for
haven't seen.
just the obvious things, but when the transformation scene in that movie, there's a really cool thing. His fingers become elongated and he's holding them up in front of his face, and it's just like they're getting super long, and the look on the guy's face who's transforming, he's like, "Oh my God, what the hell is happening to me?" So it's a real small thing, but I think it's a nod. And lastly, Hot Tub writes, "But I digress. I believe Ethan went to the seminary as a teen and found himself to be in a bit of trouble. He has a wonderful grasp of Latin and the religious ways that lend itself to this speculation. I wonder if he was doing his own version of an exorcism. Please bear with my ignorance, Steve. I am fumbling my way through this. The prayer slash chanting that he did seems to exorcise the demon from Vanessa. I may be reading more into this scene than I need to, but it seems important to his history. So do you think, I have something that I wrote for that, but I mean, do you think that he possibly went to seminary as a youth or?
I did last episode, but now that I found out that that prayer could have been a common prayer, so I definitely, I believe he was raised Roman Catholic. That's all I can
say. Yeah, yeah. As far as your ignorance to bear with, there is none to bear with. You're not being ignorant. This is all, you know, speculation. I mean, science doesn't really even acknowledge that possession is real. So, I mean, we're all just playing on a speculative field here. And if you're a deeply religious person, you're definitely going to believe it. But, you know, when I did research on exorcism to say some of the stuff that I said in the last podcast, one of the things that comes up first is it talks about how the exorcist has the power of Jesus's authority behind him, and that's what the demon abides by. That's why it's able to be cast out. But Jews, who also have a rite of exorcism, don't believe in Jesus Christ as the Son of God. As a historical figure, yes, but not as the returned Son of God. So how are they able to do it? So there obviously has to be some leeway in this. And I think the reason why, and M had said what he was actually saying when he held up the little amulet or thing to her forehead earlier in the episode. It was a prayer to St. Jude.
Yeah, St. Jude, glorious apostle, faithful servant, friend of Jesus, pray for her.
Yeah, and this is, I mean, really, it's not that different than in The Exorcist when, you know, Father Marin and Father Karras are yelling at the top of their lungs, the power of Christ compels you. It's, Ethan didn't exorcise her, I believe he didn't. He didn't exorcise her by having the vested powers and permission of the Roman Catholic Church. He did it through sheer force of will. And what is willpower if not a faith? Willpower is faith because you're willing yourself to believe in something that you have no tangible proof of. So he simply used his willpower and, you know, a good amount of spit to push this thing out. And he didn't do it all the way. He just pushed it back into the recesses of her mind because it's still there with her.
I was going to ask, because did he actually exorcise or did he just subdue it?
I think he subdued it.
Yeah. Because otherwise, why is she approaching the priest for exorcism?
Yeah. And, you know, and I looked at it, I looked at the story from a few different ways. And one of the things that I keep coming back to is that, you know, to be an exorcist, you have to have the permission of a bishop or a cardinal or the Holy Roman Church, what have you. But going back to the Exorcist movie, again, you know, Father Marin is dead. The Roman ritual has actually failed. They weren't able to do what they set out to do. But Father Karras pulled the demon out of Regan McNeil through sheer force of will. He said, take me, come into me. She pulled off the amulet that was protecting him, and bam, it was done. He jumps out the window with demon in tow, and end of story. But I think Ethan was doing something similar. Nothing else was working, and he basically just through sheer force of will forced that thing to, at the very least, recede back into the subconscious somehow. And I think that's all I had on that. But, Woody, do you have anything to add to that?
I don't, actually.
And our other piece of feedback was actually from D. Cody, and it was really nice. I didn't print it up to read it online because she's not actually watching the show at this time. She's listening to our coverage of it and just kind of imagining the show in that way, which I think is really cool. You know, she's listening to us talk about it and trying to imagine. And I think she's mentioned that she is going to watch it at some point.
She's one of our listeners from our Vikings podcast, The Wild Hunt.
Yeah, yeah. Sorry, yeah. I should have mentioned that. But she didn't really have any speculations to add or anything like that since she hasn't seen the show. But I'm sure when she does watch it and then when we get around to season two, you know, she'll be a very active participant in it. So, and I'd just like to say thank you to both those guys for writing us. It's really nice to hear from you.
Thanks for, you know, continuing to listen to us, you know, come over and check out another show that you might not have checked out on your own. Like, at least I know Hot Tub wouldn't have.
Yeah. Yeah, and I hope I didn't spoil anything from The Exorcist if any of the listeners haven't seen that movie. I guess I did, but sorry about that.
I think it's a...
spoiler alert. It came out in the 70s, though.
Yeah, that's what I was about to say.
Yeah, it's 2014. I mean, yeah. we can only hold this for so long.
Or you can just get with it and shut up. please go to iTunes. You can access that also through our webpage if you aren't sure how to get there. And rate us and or review us on iTunes. And das ist alles.
That's all, folks.
I'm Em.
And I'm Steve.
And I'm the devil. Now kindly undo these straps.
This was a No Ship Network podcast brought to you by Axolotl Tank Productions.
Aw, man, Trey, look up at the sky. It's a full moon on the Sabbath.
This is scary.
Break it down.
I was working late on my Haftorah when I heard a knock on my bedroom door. I opened it up, and to my surprise, there was a werewolf standing there with glowing gold eyes. He says, tomorrow, my son, you will be a man. But tonight's the time to join the Wolfen Clan. Tomorrow you will stand at the beamer and pray. But tonight, let's gaze at the moon and bathe. Werewolf bar mitzvah, spooky, scary. Boys becoming men, men becoming wolves. Werewolf bar mitzvah, spooky, scary. Boys becoming men, men becoming wolves.
All right, that was great, Trey. Okay, it's over. That's a wrap.
Oh. The next day, what happened? The Toma didn't teach.
Oh,
I got up in front of everyone to give my little speech. Then my teeth turned into fangs and my nails into claws. And I nearly dropped the Torah when my hands turned into paws. I growled and I roared and my rabbi did as well. It was a rocking werewolf zoo at Temple Beth Emanuel.
Hey man, where'd you learn all these Jewish words?
My manager, Harvey Lemmings. Werewolf bar mitzvah, spooky, scary. Boys becoming men, men becoming wolves.
I just don't think the idea of the song can sustain itself for that long. It seems a little sweaty now, so.
This whole premise is sweaty. We had a reception at the Larchmont Country Club. They served a real nice brisket and an 8-foot party, so.